On this episode, we have lead applications engineer, Dan Peter.
We also talk about where to get your start in Salesforce.
Going from social outcast to internet extrovert.
Thunder! 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 Thunder!
Welcome to the Thunder Nerds, where we're thinking about getting robot legs. A risky procedure, but we think it's worth it. I am now and forever JD Riot.
I'm Eric Shin.
And I am Frederick Philip Von Weiss. And you are listening to the Thunder Nerds, a design and developer discussion for all levels in the industry that love what they do and do web good. Robot legs?
Robot legs.
I would like some robot legs.
I'm thinking of getting metal legs. It's a risky operation, but it'll be worth it.
Do you know what movie it's from?
Oh, Fuckles. No, I don't. What movie is that?
Are you serious? Really? Grandma's Boy.
Oh, see, I only watch pieces of Grandma's Boy. I haven't seen the whole thing.
That hurts my soul.
Yeah, sorry. I haven't seen the whole thing. From what I watched, it was really funny. But I like to watch the whole thing and have robot legs.
You can't talk like that once the lion gets here.
Oh, jeez. I gotta watch that. Well, I guess speaking of things with robot legs and all things that are mechanical, let's go ahead and get right into it without any further ado and welcome our guest, lead applications engineer, Dan Peter. Welcome, sir.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well. Very well, thank you. How about yourself? Great.
Excellent. Oh, I'm doing great. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on. We appreciate that. So, Dan, let's just go ahead and jump right in. Before we get too far, I guess, in Salesforce community and everything that goes with that, let's go ahead and explore some of your background and build a lexicon for reference for everybody about where you got started, how you got started, where your passions came from. A little bit of your background, schooling, and everything like that.
Every time you say that, I think of that part in the first part of Interview with a Vampire, and I stop myself from saying it. It's like, what should I do? It's like, I was born, I grew up. I mean, should I start like David Copperfield?
So Dan, when you saw me in the alleyway and was thinking about drinking my blood, and I lit up a cigarette. So where did you get your start? And we'll go to the vampire stuff later.
Sure. Well, somehow at an early age, I kind of discovered that you could take things and do things with them and make them do other things. And I was just kind of fascinated by this. So, as a kid, pretty much the day after I had all my toys, they were all taken apart and turned into other types of contraptions. So I think that's kind of the genesis of where all this passion for what's now software development originally came from. It's... Mm-hmm. Kind of takes different forms. Right now it happens to be primarily software development, but as a kid and as a teenager, it's taken all different forms. But kind of that hello world moment where you you turn the switch on or you hit the enter key and you see something really cool happen that kind of you created, I think that's sort of the genesis of my passion. So from a very early age, I used to get my hands on all different types of computers. So there was a Mac Classic and TRS-80 kind of in the earliest days. I used to do HyperCard scripting. I don't know if anyone knows HyperCard, but I used to make video games. I even made kind of a communications terminal and ultimately some BBS software and HyperCard scripting.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was totally terrible architecture and platform, but it worked. So
sometimes that's all that matters.
Yeah, and then I'm sure you remember, I don't want to date you guys too much here, but people used to actually distribute programs in paper books and you'd type them into the computer. Did you guys ever do any of that?
Oh, man.
Yeah,
the closest thing was VIC-20.
Yeah, I did plenty of that on the TRS-80s and Commodores. Eventually worked my way up to some PCs, played around with basic programming, and then some of these sort of pre-internet online services like CompuServe, AOL, Prodigy, these types of things, and kind of work my way into better and better PCs. You know, I'd build one and then sell it to somebody and take the money and buy better parts and, you know, go all the way from something like a XT all the way up to, you know, 386, 486, you know, Pentium 1, 2, 3, 4, and just kind of leapfrog my way up the PC chain. So I used PCs for kind of the bulk of my career. I was really PC guy, but I'm on a Mac now. But, you know, back to the kind of Mac, or back to the PC sort of highlights. So I think I was around 13 years old. I was running a bulletin board service. And, you know, it started out, you know, 9 p.m., the house phone turned into the BBS line,
on a 9400 baud modem, or 9600 baud.
Yeah.
I mean, so what you're really saying is this really isn't even a passion of yours. I mean, you're late in the game, right? I mean, 9 years old, 3 years old, that's kind of late in the game, right?
Yeah, you missed that window of opportunity there.
Some people had friends. I had inventions, you know.
Ones and zeros. I was surrounded by ones and zeros. It's like fucking the number 23 in your room, I bet.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the interesting thing, right? The BBS has actually kind of became a social gateway for me. So it all kind of worked out in the end. And, it, you know, the machines kind of were able, and the programming was able to bring me the social network, the friends. There was, back then, there was meetups for the BBSs. So you actually got to meet people in person. It was probably mostly, you know, typing messages back and forth, but then we'd occasionally all get together. So, you know, I did that and graduated up through all the, you know, the full-fledged, had my own phone line running the BBS and, you know, had all the hard drives stacked with files and this kind of stuff. And
you were already ahead of the game, like when Quake started becoming a big thing. You were probably talking mad shit. You're like, dude, I've been doing this for years, kid.
Oh, yeah, it was Wolfenstein 3D, man.
Well, yeah, but Wolfenstein didn't have a Wolfenstein. You couldn't talk shit back and forth. Quake, you could though. Like you, or Team Fortress 2.
Oh,
like,
nice.
Are you kidding? You could talk back and forth like crazy on that. You were already like what, 6 years into the game before that happened.
Yeah, so that's interesting aspect. So I definitely have played all of those games from the beginning, all the way through, but I never became so much of a gamer. A lot of my friends did. A lot of my friends were big into gaming. They did it as a career. But for me, it was all about the challenge of getting a computer built up that you could run the game on, you know, get a copy of the game, maybe hack the game a little bit, put some different faces on the characters. But I never got sucked into playing it for very many hours. So a little different in that regard, but definitely had full exposure to the whole scene in terms of gaming.
So how was your family in support of this? Did your parents get you kind of into computers? Did you have a computer in the house growing up? Were they cool with you turning the phone line on at 9 o'clock and doing this?
Yeah, so I would say there was definitely some support there, but I don't think it was, it was never, you know, when you talk about the genesis of it, I think it was kind of me discovering these types of things on my own, and then I did get some support. So I had family members with businesses, with old computers they would hand me down from their business. You know, they'd scrap them when they'd upgrade, stuff like that. So had some support for sure, but it wasn't like, you know, hey, you need to learn computers, this is going to be a good thing for you. It was more like, oh, hey, you're already into computers, why don't you take this? You know, that kind of thing. So.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. So they were more following you, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think so. And then you know how it goes. As soon as you hit a certain age, you're pretty much everybody's on call computer technician. So,
yeah, you're tech support for the family.
Exactly. So definitely still do that to some degree.
Oh, and you will do that until you die. Yeah. Or until your younger nephew gets smarter than you. Who knows?
Yeah. Or until everybody loses their eyesight.
Yeah, that happens too. But who knows? Maybe
we'll have robot eyes by that time.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's either that or Back to the Vampires, or when we're 85, we'll drink a glass of nanites and become 20 again.
Yeah, I'll take one.
Yeah, the Internet of Things will save us. Who knows? Or be full-on Ghost in the Shell.
Mm-hmm.
So exactly. Tell us about your career then, Dan. How did you go from that to making that a career? Where did you start off?
Well, it was kind of obvious, since I was, say, 13, programming, running BBS, it was kind of obvious that was the direction I was headed, but I didn't know exactly what angle I wanted to do on it, you know. So I did plenty of consulting work, you know, maybe started word of mouth, got into, I did this while I was in high school, junior college, took different forms. Newspaper actually worked really well for a while because a lot of people that aren't really literate on the computers happen to be reading the newspaper. So I did a newspaper ad that said something like, I'll fix any computer problem for cheap. And I got all kinds of action off of that one. I just went in and, you know, did anything you can imagine, from taking viruses off computers to fixing a network on a small business, a lot of that type of stuff. So I think at a certain point I did so much of this stuff, I realized how important the business end of it was. And that's when it started taking shape. You know, I didn't want to focus on too much calculus. I didn't want to learn how to maybe build a computer chip. I wanted to kind of take these computer skills and figure out how to monetize them, you know, figure out some cool new business, some way to maybe make a computer system for a business that could make it super efficient, different aspects like that. So that's when I started realizing just how important the business was. And I didn't want to go to school and learn more computers. I wanted to go to school and learn marketing, you know, learn accounting, learn some business strategy. You know, how do you take what you're good at and really match it to the market and come out winning? So
So what did you do then for school? What kind of education did you get to do this?
Yeah, well, you know, the whole social thing, being primarily on computers and not so interested in the social aspects of things like high school, I actually was taking junior college courses in high school to graduate high school. So, you know, that was kind of just a treasure trove, kid in a candy store. You know, I looked at the course catalog. There was, you know, web design, Photoshop, Linux, C++ programming.
Really? You know, wow. Yeah. That's nice. I didn't have any shit like that in my high school. That's amazing.
This was in the junior college. Pascal. Yeah, this was in the junior RPG. College. So.
Wow. Eric, yes. What were you saying?
I was saying the only things that that we had in our schools, I was in actually two high schools. The first one was RPG, which is a report program generator. Basically, it's a lot of it's saying, because they're going to be in a printout form. So you would have to dictate, oh, okay, so this line is 128 characters long. If I want to center text, I have to say go to, you know, X number of spaces and then start typing out text. It was crazy. It was on a IBM System 36 a mini computer with dumb terminals. And then I changed high schools because I wanted to take Turbo Pascal.
Yeah, in my high school, all we had was like the Visual Performing Arts program. And when I say all, I mean it was good, but it wasn't something like that. But so what? So from high school, what did you do? You went to what college?
Yeah, so I had a bit of an interesting path. So I did I did junior college while in high school. Transitioned, graduated high school, continued to take junior college for my general ed requirements. And I actually did take a break in there where I was working at the time. It was kind of the first dot-com bubble, and there was very good jobs in San Francisco. I was working for AT&T Internet doing tech support, and I just got to the point where I could solve any problem with my eyes closed, and I'm like, it's time to go back to school. So so I went back to the same junior college, kept doing the general ed, the computer courses, and then they had a college fair there, and I stopped by, and I kind of had my eye on Chico State because some other family members, aunts and uncles, people I had known, said they had a great time there, and they had a good business program, specifically MIS. So I applied there, and you know, they said, come over now. I was thinking they'd say, you know, come by next semester, come by next year. But they said, no, let's transfer now. So I did. And it was great. I got the college experience, you know, but I also got, I got kind of introduced into the formal world of this business education, which was brand new for me. You know, I hacked on computers as a little kid, but I never understood, you know, how do you put a business together with this stuff? So I did the MIS there, got through that, I think, in about 2.5 years, did a lot of summer school, you know, intersessions, stacked up a lot of units, you know, 17, 21 units, that kind of thing, and got through that. And the whole time I was there at Chico State, I was actually working, you know, I was doing some of the Craigslist stuff, and I graduated there, continued to work. I worked about a year doing, I had a consulting business for myself at that time, by that time, and I had one client that was really my biggest client. You know, the vast majority of my work was from him, and this guy was an amazing entrepreneur. He basically owned kind of a specialty insurance business for construction, and he developed a whole suite of applications, you know, that I had built for him. He came up with this stuff that just ran his business end to end, and it was like, you know, exactly what I thought, what I was hoping to get out of this MIS education, and you know, here I was getting to do it in real life. So that he had this whole suite of applications, and at the end of it, he could push a button and his job was done. It would send a huge packet of information off, you know, to the surety company, basically submitting a contractor to get surety credit, and you know, just total, like, total winning story for automation. Very cool stuff.
And that's at what age now? You were how old?
Oh shoot, I was
in your 20s, 30s.
Yeah, I would say right around there, right around late 20s.
And then, but yeah, after that, you still continued your education, right?
I was doing that kind of simultaneously. I took a year off from school. Uh-huh. I was working for this guy, and decided to go back. I wanted to do more business education, and you know, in hindsight, it may or may not have been worth it, but I knew at the time, even at the time, I wasn't sure if it was going to be worth it to do the MBA, but I said, you know, this is the time to do it. I'm never going to go back and do it later. So whether I should or not, at least I know it's the right time. So,
well, having an MBA certainly opens a lot of opportunity doors and gets people to look at you. So you did get your MBA, and I believe you were talking about you got your MBA while living in a van on campus. How did you, where did you get the money for school, and how did you do that while you were living in a van?
And the money, sure, for the van.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting story, really. So I just heard somebody, you know, talking about this, and I guess the same way, you know, a lot of the computer hacking, hardware hacking, a lot of the same reasons this stuff intrigues me, you know, life hacking kind of stuff really does. And I heard somebody talking about this. They said they got through their college experience living in kind of a homemade RV, you know. And so I was over at UC Davis, and I'm like, hey, this campus is full of these white Dodge utility vans. You know, it's the maintenance crew. If I had a van just like this, I would just blend right in, you know. So
good point, man.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and you know, I was actually paying rent for a place, you know, back home, Sonoma County, Sebastopol area, and I didn't want to pay rent up there at school. So what I would do is I would drive up there for the week, and I would stay in this van, and then come back on the weekends to work. So you know, it's really it was really a good decision, not only because it saved money, but it really forced me to focus on school. So nobody wants to hang out in a van, right? So I was hanging out in the lot.
What are you talking about? Are you telling me that this isn't where you met your wife? Yeah. this isn't the story that brings us unending love. I mean, come on, don't ruin my dreams and hopes.
Yeah, not many people know about this actually. So you guys are the first to hear it, but exclusive. So I spent most of my time in the library and go back to the van, say at midnight when the library closes. So, wake up in the morning, go to the gym, use their showers. It's good for your health. It's also good for your education, you know?
Well, there's so many amenities to leverage in your school that you're already paying for. So you could pretty much live at the school, and you really just need a place to sleep at night, exactly. Per se, but, or you could sleep in the library.
Exactly. So, you know, it was fun. It's interesting memories. And I was very serious about school at that time. I wanted to get through it, wanted to work hard at it, didn't want to do a lot of social activities. I wanted to use any free time I had to work. So it met all my requirements perfectly. Interesting story.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think it's a good story of inspiration for anybody that if you really want to do something like that, you can. You have to make some sacrifices, like live in a van, but you could do it, especially when you're young. You know, if you're in your late 20s, early 30s, who gives a fuck? Do it, get your education, because that's the time to do it. And now you have a fucking MBA. You could do anything you want with that, which that just reinforces all the other things that you already had force behind you on from age 13. You know, this is what you were meant to do. You were meant to be a problem solver.
Yeah, it definitely was a little bit of a problem solve and a creative solution. I relish those opportunities a little more than maybe your average person. So for me, a lot of the payoff is in the thrill of seeing something work out like that, you know. So
let's talk a little bit now about what you're actually doing. So you're a lead application engineer at, and let me make sure I'm saying this name right, it's Kennedy Inc.?
No, but that's what most people would say. The founder, she's a legend here in Silicon Valley. Her name's Sandy Kurtzig. She actually has two sons named Ken and Andy, and she put them together, and it's pronounced Kenandy.
Kenandy, I like that a lot. That's a cool story.
Yeah, I think it's good luck. Her previous company was named after the initials of her kids as well, and she was kind of the first woman to take a tech company public here in the Valley. Her company was very successful, so we're hoping for another big success.
I love that name, though, combining the family members. That's pretty cool, and like that comes together to, you know, her passion for family and then passion for career. I mean, you can't have one without the other if you don't have a good base where you're going to jump from, right?
Yeah, I think she's actually written a book about her story. If you want to read it sometime, it's called CEO, and she talks about how she did that, so I'd recommend that one. Really an amazing woman, and, you know, most of the reason, big part of the reason why I'm here, so.
So what do you do over there? What is it, a lead application developer? So what does that mean? What kind of development are you doing?
Yeah, so we're building a product. It's an ERP application. I don't know if the listeners know what ERP is, but it's basically business software to run every aspect of your business from, you know, building your products, purchasing your supplies, selling your products to your customers, you know, accounting for everything, and the list goes on and on. ERP is just a massive beast, and these companies like Oracle and SAP have really kind of had, you know, sort of a monopoly in the market for 30 years, and there's a lot of horror stories associated with these things. So what Kenandy does is they actually give the business the ability to run all this same functionality, but kind of without the horror stories, on a platform that's, you know, lower cost, more agile, more configurable. And it's a lot like the way you would install an app on your smartphone from an app store. So Salesforce actually has something called the App Exchange. So you get kind of a clean slate. You know, you buy your Salesforce org, you know, which kind of is just an empty space waiting to create database tables, users, all that kind of stuff. And you install an app on that from the AppExchange, and now you've kind of, you know, kind of like you customize your cell phone to do some functionality. You're sort of customizing your Salesforce org to run your business on. You can sort of bolt all these different pieces together and then build your own custom stuff that sits in between them and on top of them and all that. So, you know, kind of we're trying to chunk out our piece of market share on all these awful legacy vendors of ERP with something, something that gets the job done, with actually a pleasant experience. And
well, there's a lot of opportunity for enterprise resource planning. The market is almost infinite, right? Virtually infinite, at least. I don't think there's a lot of people that do what Salesforce does in the same category or really the same kind of value that they provide. Maybe there's a handful. I can't think of too many, but Salesforce seems to be the dominant leader in that.
Yeah, so I switched to Salesforce in 2009. Maybe I can mention that briefly. The company I was at before Kanandy was Safari Books Online. They're owned by O'Reilly, and that's kind of what got me started down the Salesforce path. You know, basically subprime mortgage crisis hit around 2008, 2009, and I had to decide. That was a career changer for a lot of people, me included. So I had to decide, do I want to get some new clients or, you know, because my clients were having some troubles, or do I want to go take a full-time gig? And a full-time Salesforce gig opened up, and I started researching Salesforce. And I said, you know what, this really is the way kind of app development and hosting, provisioning, this is the way things need to go. You know, get rid of as many of those non-value-added activities as you can. So, you know, as a developer, when you're sitting down, you're actually building cool stuff, not just kind of laying the same groundwork over and over and over again. So that's kind of what got me into that around 2009. And I worked for Safari Books Online and kind of did a lot of integration, sort of providing them the 360-degree customer view, more on the customer relationship management side of Salesforce. But all during that time, Salesforce, they're what they now call the App Cloud, which is, you know, something you can build and run custom apps on, that was growing and growing. So I realized there's new opportunities, not just for Salesforce to be CRM software, but you can actually build any application on this thing. And so, you know, when I saw this company, Kanandy, they're building a full-blown ERP on top of Salesforce, you know, that was pretty exciting to me. So Salesforce is stuck with that name, Salesforce, but they're really, you know, platform as a service basically right now. So you can build anything you want on them, and people are, and, you know, they work great with kind of most of the latest and greatest technologies.
If you're in the industry, you have an idea that it's not just a CRM, it's a whole lot more, but maybe people outside of it just think of Salesforce as a buzzword for CRM. There's so much you could do with Salesforce. We have a buddy that was on a previous post that talked a lot about what he did with using like Alexa to use voice commands to run Salesforce applications. That was pretty cool. It's very versatile.
Yeah, they really did a API first implementation. So, you know, works very well with any of this, you know, you mentioned Alexa, any of these IoT technologies, any of that stuff can easily, you can, you get full blown APIs out of the box. Plus you can write your own custom APIs. So
it's very, an exciting time.
Yeah. Very, very open. It's pretty much not the technology that's your limiting factor. It's kind of your imagination, you know?
Yeah. Oh, you know what I wanted to mention? I think this is also pretty exciting. You were recently named number 17 on a list of 30 Salesforce experts to follow on Twitter. And that's from level11.com.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised, but, you know, also not so surprised. I was a bit of a late adopter to things like Twitter, but You know, they're basically like, you know, that's almost your sole source of truth for information these days. I mean, if you watch the news, they're quoting Twitter. You watch the blogs, they're quoting Twitter. So it's just a super efficient way to stream everything and just really keep a pulse on what's going on in the world. So I really started out as a consumer of Twitter, maybe around 2010. And, you know, as a consumer, reading this stuff, I got more and more interested. I became more kind of an engager. And I, you know, when I find things, I would retweet them, reply. And I just started connecting the dots between things I was reading and people. And I kind of moved maybe into, you know, more of an influencer. So actually, when I said things, there was enough people following me where they, you know, it actually would maybe have some influence on them. So it's kind of, I think on the social side, it's really opened a lot of doors for me. You know, some of it's, you know, maybe you can think of it as, you know, branding or self-promotion, but I try to think of it more as just building social capital and just meeting people so you know when you have a question, you know who to go to, or when they have a question, they know to come to you. And it's opened so many interesting doors. You know, that's maybe one of the reasons why you guys are talking to me right now. You found out, maybe you found out about me through that, I'm not sure, but a lot of things
that
like
is,
this.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. I mean, when you talk, you speak, Dan, to, I'm looking at your Twitter page, over 11,000 people right away. So you said something, and we saw it.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, you know, when you talk about career, that whole social capital, it's basically making your, it's giving you the ability, you know, it's to connect your brain, everybody else's brain in real time. I mean, that's not something you can do, you know, otherwise. So,
yeah.
I think on the career front, that's the biggest thing. It's kind of, it's an investment you make and you don't know what the return is going to be, but there is a return. It's very interesting. Opportunities pop up. And, so I think in terms of the life, the biggest impact there is you get to do more interesting stuff. I was invited to go check out, you know, various things. They, you know, kind of lumped me in the category as a blogger. And so, you know, whether you blog or not, you kind of get branded as a influencer. And I was invited to check out the Solar Impulse. You know, I was right there with Larry Page, Sergey Brin, you know, Google founders in the same room there checking out this this awesome solar airplane flying around the world. And, you know, things like that, you know, video shoots, photo shoots. So that part makes your life, enriches your life a bit, you know, beyond the career. Those are kind of extracurricular activities. But, you know, on the negative side, on the life, it does mean you have to try a little bit harder for the work-life balance and to keep the stress levels down, because you can get into overload situation pretty easily. But just learn your limits and then kind of stay within them and kind of consciously spend some time every day to keep the stress levels down. And
yeah, because you don't only do that, right? Like, you're also a Salesforce user group organizer, and you do that. What is it, the MacGyver? What's the URL?
Yeah, well, my personal blog is MacGyverForce.com, and, you know, there's, I think I watched MacGyver as a kid growing up, and, you know, most of the stuff I saw was like, oh, that'll never work, and I went out and made something cooler, you know, but I still love the shows. Entertaining. And people have actually called me MacGyver before, and then the Force is also from Salesforce. So MacGyver Force is the blog. But yeah, I love these user groups. I started one, I think it was around 2011 maybe, and in the North Bay when I was living there, I started a Salesforce developer user group. And when I moved down to the peninsula south of San Francisco, I actually had to hand that user group over because I was too far away to lead it. So it's still going, it's doing well. But I really missed having a user group. And then a couple of years later, the San Francisco Bay Area developer user group opened up, and it's kind of the oldest and one of the largest groups. So it all worked out. I got to help organize that one, and now I'm kind of the sole organizer of this thing. And you know, that's really cool. Being in San Francisco, where Salesforce is located, means you kind of can easily get all the best guests because they're already right there, you know. So
I mean, one thing I was kind of curious about is I mean, starting a group is something that sounds like a lot of hard work, a lot of time, but a load of fun. Are there any suggestions or advice you would have for someone who would like to start a group to give back to the community? I mean, is there like a how-to on the interwebs floating around?
Yeah, actually, there's a lot of this kind of stuff. There's actually books written on it. But Salesforce is a bit of an interesting animal because they actually have a lot of support for this. They have, you know, they provide you some resources, both on the planning side, even on the budget side. So, you know, there's actually a Salesforce-specific blog. It's leaderforce.wordpress.com, and it's kind of written by some user group leaders that are aiming to help other user group leaders. So that's a pretty good one to check out. My personal advice is, you know, you got to find the users somehow. Because they're really, you know, they're going to be the lifeblood of this thing. They're the people that are going to be inspired and inspire others. So you can work with Salesforce, and they can actually email folks in your area to try to help you. Because you kind of have to get it started somehow. These people are just going about their day. You have to sort of break through and get a hold of them, you know. So they know who their customers are. They can actually email the customers, let them know, hey, we're starting a user group in your area. And, you know, then transfer that over to something like meetup.com, and now you've kind of got your own virtual community going where you can then hold the physical meetings, you know, talk about plan for. You can do things like survey the group, and you can bring in the the topics that they're most interested in. So it's really cool. I mean, Salesforce kind of runs the gamut of different industries. And so depending on what area of the U.S. or the world you're in, your particular local user group might have a different angle to it. You know, it might be more of a manufacturing type crowd, or more of a winery type crowd, or maybe it's more of a high-tech software, something like that. So you really get to hear the stories of how people are using Salesforce, what kind of cool stuff they've built, and, you know, suggest ways to help them, like, if they're saying, you know, we're all having a lot of trouble with this, well, let's find the guy who wrote this and bring him in, you know?
Wow. That's an awesome resource. I mean,
yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, one of the things that you talked about that was really interesting to me was, and I think a lot of people are kind of like, you're either all in or you're all out. A lot of people don't have what you were talking about, which is that work-life balance. How long did it take somebody who's been coding since they were in the third grade to figure out work-life balance? And, like, I mean, like, that's it. And I have a feeling that, like, your work-life balance is going to be different than other people's. Like,
yeah, it is. I'm a bit of an anomaly in that regard. Doing double work has always been kind of just normal to me. I don't know, maybe I should see a psychologist for some of these issues or something like that, but
probably, but that's it either. But when did the idea
I need to see that person too.
When did the idea of work life hit?
Yeah.
When did that become something in your life that needed to happen? Because it doesn't seem like that would be something that you would consider if it was just work and life in your life. If that makes sense.
It does.
So what came along?
Yeah, I don't think I ever worried about work-life balance. You know, I am married. I do have a son, and I can't remember any time I worried about work-life balance before that. I think it was pretty much a challenge to see how much school and how much work I could cram in every day. or how, you know, how many amazing things I could do, like put a new engine in my car on the weekend or something like that. So I think it probably didn't hit right away with having a kid and being married. I think it's taken some years to develop that, and I think I still struggle with it, but you know, basically I think everybody goes through this at different points in their life, but you realize you know, the importance of the other things in your life and how you know, you see examples of things, you know, tragedies and things like this, and it sort of makes you realize, oh, hey, I need to stop and smell the roses a little more, do something, you know, spontaneous with my family or this, these types of things. So I've definitely hit that point. I'd say I still struggle with it a lot, but at least I'm aware of it. And, you know, I do,
sure, yeah,
you know, I do try to get home while it's still light sometimes.
Yeah. Well, being, I think just being cautious of it, or conscious, I should say, not cautious, conscious of it is kind of, I think, for people like, for like you, like if your wife understands you, that's the endearing thing. It's like the fact that you are getting home before the lights are out or something like that has got to be the thing that she's like, okay, he cares still.
And he's not spending the night at the library.
Yeah, no, it works. It helps with the family. The family, you do that, you make these small changes, and it actually, you know, you notice the difference. You can tell the family actually appreciates it and makes a big difference for them. I think the other thing is,
man, that's awesome.
You know, keeping on top of your health as you get older is really important. And that ends up being, yeah, almost like a fuse, you know, because something will pop, and then you'll realize you gotta dial the load down a little bit, you know. So
yeah, right around 27, I think you figure out that your body fucking hates you, and it's hated you the whole time, but it's just it waited 27 years to get its real revenge, and it usually happens when you sneeze. So you're like, oh shit, oh god, here it is. It's like a prison fight. You just got shanked and you didn't even know what the hell happened. You're like, what is this? I'm invincible.
What's a hernia?
No. Yeah, exactly. What's a hernia from just a simple throw?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, sitting at a computer all day is not good for you. So you can get away with it when you're younger, but when you get older, you need to throw the balance in there if you want to keep doing it. So.
Yeah, well, sometimes you gotta rise up tabletop.com and
yeah, exactly, damn it, that's right, I was gonna do it, you stole it, you bastard.
You gotta go to riseuptabletop.com and get one of those tabletops that you could stand up and work on.
Yeah, I've done,
he owes
done
us
that.
money.
Yeah, that stuff helps, but you know, obviously there's no free lunch, and you might end up with plantar fasciitis or some knee problems or something else.
Jesus, WebMD, here we go. How about, okay, let's go. Let's get the chairs that are like that allow you to like stand up but not like sit and stuff like that to save your knees, and then get a riseuptabletop.com and grab that. But Daniel, man, thanks for taking the time on a late night to talk with us, man. It's I think we got a lot, and I think our listeners will get a little bit. A little something interesting about someone who's as committed and passionate about this as you are.
Yeah.
And has been as passionate as you have been since you were so young.
Yeah, this has been a great story.
Yeah, yeah. So anyone who's interested in Salesforce, you know, there's this great new resource called Trailhead, which is kind of a gamified learning path style approach to learning it. So I've been having a lot of fun with it, and it's perfect for people who know nothing about Salesforce and even up through intermediate or advanced developers. So if you want to learn more and maybe interested in a career change, give that a look.
They are hiring.
Oh man.
They are hiring.
We keep fucking telling somebody about that, but I don't know. He hasn't quite yet dropped the fucking. He hasn't quite yet got the hint. I don't know who it could be, but his name,
like a Yeti.
But his name rhymes with erection. So I mean, like, if you could think of like who that person might be, and maybe tweet him every day, I guess, until he actually gets off his ass and gets a job. I mean, you know. We've talked to like three of you by this point, and so that's you, Jeff Douglas, and I think one other person.
Kyle,
that, and it's like
Kyle Bauerman.
Yeah, Kyle, Bowerman, exactly, and said that. And still, this fucking dickhead hasn't got the hint yet.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, take it away,
buddy. I will get there.
But anyway, but yeah, we want to take the
subtle hint and go with it.
Yeah, but hey, we want to thank you again so much, Dan, for being on the show. Like Jonathan outlined, this has been a really interesting episode, and it's great to hear from somebody that's been doing it since they were, what did you say, 9, and found their career doing exactly what you not even kind of sought out to do, but really it sounds like you were meant to do.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it just sort of happened. I mean, that's all I knew. I stumbled into it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you stumbled into it. It really does sound like a BSG kind of destiny thing where it all happened before and will happen again to me, but I don't know.
Good reference.
Why, thank you. Tipping the hat, putting the hat back on the head for our listeners. But yes, so thank you so much, Dan. Very much appreciate it, sir.
All right, thank you, guys.